like to take this opportunity to welcome you to this meeting. We are going to have probably two presentations. That will be Facility Department from the Quality Council on Trade and Occupation, and thereafter we'll have another presentation relating to Indlela. I'm going to take this opportunity to request honourable members of Parliament in the Protocol Committee to introduce themselves, after which the department will introduce themselves according to how they are arranged in terms of their delegation. Myself, I'm Ismail Malale. I'm the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training.
Thank you. I'm Alfred Poncha. I'm a member of this committee representing the IFP, and I come from the Kingdom. Thank you.
I'm Sibusiso Radebe, a member of this portfolio committee from Mpumalanga, representing the African National Congress, United African National Congress.
I'm Wendy Nelson. I'm from a member of the committee from the Northwest Province and a member of the ANC.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Nomalunga Lokina, the whip of the committee. I also come from KZN, representing the African National Congress.
Good morning. My name is Donald Smith. I'm a member of parliament. I'm standing in for my colleague, Andriekus van der Westhuizen, who will be arriving late. Thank you.
I'm Silence Makhubela, representing the ANC. No, you can't be turning heads like that, Chair. From Limpopo, thanks.
My name is Crosby Moni, member of the committee representing the African National Congress. I'm from South Africa.
Speak to the department.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Gwebs Konde. I'm the acting DG for Higher Education and Training.
Morning, colleagues. My name is Pesi Muleke. I'm the DDG for Skills Development in the Department of Higher Education and Training.
My name is Clive Mshisa. I'm the Chief Director responsible for INDLELA, National Artisan Moderating Board. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Wilson Zimande. I'm the Chairperson of Quality Council for Trades and Occupations. Thank you. No, not really.
Good morning. My name is Adrian Bird, and I'm the Acting Chief Executive Officer for the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Mhlokwane. I'm from Palama, representing DG Palama, Professor Mulo.
Thanks. I'll take this opportunity to allow the Acting DG to facilitate the presentations.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Firstly, if I may be allowed to extend the apology of the Minister. There are cabinet committees that are sitting this morning. As a result, he sent his apology for his absence in this meeting. If you allow me, Chair, So basically, we got an invitation, which we really enthusiastically welcome from the committee to make a presentation or account on the Quality Council for Trades Occupations, which is QCTO, as well as Indlela. This is so because the QCTO is a new body that hasn't been there. And what has been happening historically, the training landscape in the country has been taking place and shapes in different forms at different times. The evolution from pre-1922, 1981, which culminated in the Manpower Training Act, which in the main worked through industry training boards that were doing accreditation for the training programs that were rolled out at that time, and later the CETAs, which established their standard generating bodies, which were doing accreditation and quality assurance at the same time for the respective CETA. But in that process, after intense interrogation as to how the training landscape could be shaped out in the country, there were initiatives to establish QCTO. And it came against the background historically where there were only two quality councils, which is Umalusi as well, Council for Higher Education, which had their main focus on academic qualifications. Now, QCTO is established to focus mainly on occupations and trade. So amongst other things it will be doing as a key mandate would be to accredit trade centers, of which at the present moment we have got Indlela, which is a trade center, which is housing NAMP, National Artisan Moderating Body, at the present moment, so that we're able to fast track the processes of artisan training as the country demands at the present moment, as the main key requirement by the economy. So I will allow at this stage a presentation to be made on the QCTO and later on the Indlela. If I may just indicate right at the beginning that at Indlela, there are some challenges that we are dealing with at the present moment. I think the presentation will actually touch on some of them, with the understanding that some of the processes, according to the legal jargon, are sub judice. But nonetheless, I think it's quite important to surface as to what is actually taking place at the present moment in regard to those issues of challenge at Indlela, and what is the response of the Department of Higher Education and Training in those. But it will come a bit later. I will allow, through you, Chair, with your permission, Percy Moleke, who is the DDG for Skills Branch in the department, to actually take us through. We start with the QCTO.
Thanks, DG. Thanks, Chair, and the members. With the acting DG having given that background to QCTO, I'll just give an update on where we are at as a department on QCTO. And I think the DG alluded to the historical background of this. So I'm not going to go into the details with regard to the historical background, but just to set the scene of how, or rather where the idea of the QC2O came from, how it emerged. And suffice to say that it emerged from a system that was fragmented, so to speak. So we had the Department of Labor and the then Department of Education, the one dealing with education, the other one dealing with training and skills development. So there was no integration between education or of education, training and skills development. And largely the Department of Labor side was guided by the SAQA Act and the Skills Development Act. And under the SAQA Act, SAQA was setting standards or qualification and registering them on the NQF. And this was done by recognizing the SGBs, the standard generating bodies, which did the work for schools and colleges. And then there were CETAs, which also established in many respects their own SGBs under SAQA, and they developed their own sectoral qualifications. And the quality assurance thereof was done by SAQA accredited ETQAs, which are located in the CETAs. That was under the Department of Labor. And then under the former Department of Education, there was a parallel process from what was happening in the Department of Labor. And in the former Department of Education, what happened was the higher education section, which was the universities, were quality assured by the CHE, Council for Higher Education, as an ETQA. And FET, the schools and colleges, were quality assured by Umalusi. So that gives a picture, basically, of the pre-2008 ETQAs on the NQF, the National Qualification Framework, where you had the CHE, then you had Umalusi, and you had the CETAs doing their own thing. And more importantly is the fact that the CHE and Umalusi were located in one department, which was the former Department of Education, and then the ETQAs under the CETAs were located in the Department of Labor. The proposals then for the QC2O emerged. So as the picture has shown, the system was inefficient. So there was an interministerial review on the NQF, which began in 2001. And it was a very lengthy, I'm sure most of the colleagues here know about that review process. It was a very lengthy and difficult process. And this resulted in a joint ministerial statement between the Minister of Labor and Minister of the former Department of Education in 2007. And the statement envisioned the third quality council, which was the QC2O, which would operate alongside Umalusi and the CHE. And all the three QCs were meant to both to set standards and qualifications as well as quality assure. SAQA was given the role then to enhance communication, coordination and collaboration amongst the three QCs. So that was how QC2O emerged, basically. It was to try and mediate the differences between the two departments. The Skills Development Act was then amended in 2008, and the QC2O was then inserted into the Skills Development Act. And as per the Skills Development Act now, as it stands, the QC2O is responsible for establishing and maintaining occupational standards and qualifications, quality assure occupational standards and qualifications and learning in and for the workplace, designing and developing occupational standards and qualifications and submitting them to SAQA for registration on the NQF, and ensuring the quality of occupational standards and qualifications and learning in and for the workplace. Now, as per the Skills Development Act, the minister has the responsibility of setting policy on occupational standards and qualifications. Specifically, the Act says that the minister has the responsibility to determine policy on an occupational qualifications sub-framework as an integral part of the NQF, the sub-framework for quality assurance for occupational qualifications, and any other matter concerning occupational standards or occupational qualifications. Now, I am saying that one of the things that we have to be careful of in relation to policy matters is we don't get into the NQF trap, where the skills development system centers around the qualification framework, as we have done in the past 10, 15 years or so, where the NQF to some extent has in fact become a constraint in understanding and pursuing skills development issues of articulation and integration. So we have to be very careful with that. And hence I'm mentioning these things with respect to the responsibility of the minister in terms of setting up policy. Now, continuing on that policy-related matters, the SDA defines an occupational qualification as a qualification associated with a trade, occupation, or profession resulting from work-based learning and consisting of knowledge unit standards, practical unit standards, and work experience unit standards. Now, by implication, the above and in the previous lines, before the occupational sub-framework for trades and occupations could be published, there must be alignment with other sub-frameworks, UMALUSI and CHE. We cannot have a sub-framework or three sub-frameworks that do not talk to each other without integration, without articulation. So those are the matters that we have to resolve before we can even move any further, or some of the matters that have to be resolved. This is a nice picture. Adrian draws very nice pictures, but it's very telling. And it basically says you have the three sub-frameworks, and we have to have alignment between all of these sub-frameworks. So on the left-hand side, the 1 to 10 is the NQF bands, and you have the red part, which is the CHE part, and then the blue part, which is the UMALUSI part, and then the proposed, then which is the green part, the occupational qualification framework. So we have to make sure that when at the end of the day, I don't know which day that is, but it has to be one day soon, all of these things talk to each other, there's integration and articulation. So we need to clarify the overlaps and contradictions in the sub-frameworks, as I've said, clarify the roles and responsibilities with other QCs, and especially UMALUSI on the theoretical component. We know that UMALUSI is currently responsible for the N courses and the NCV. Now, the N courses and NCV are a sub or a part of a qualification. So if we take artisans, for example, for you to become an artisan, you have to do the theoretical component, which is the N courses, and then the workplace part of it, and then do the trade test, and then become an artisan if you pass. Now, all of these have to speak to each other. Currently, UMALUSI is responsible for the theoretical component, which is in the FET colleges. Now, the CTAS, in many respects, are responsible for the work component of it. And that's the proposal where QC2O is going to come in. And then there's a trade test, which some happen in the CETA, some happen in LELA. And we have to clarify the roles and responsibilities and overlaps amongst all of these to make sure that the system is clear. But we also have to clarify the roles and responsibilities with the CETAs and NAMP, the National Artisan Moderating Body, which the DG has alluded to, that it's also a newly established body, and It was inserted in the amendments of the FDA as well in 2008. Now, NAMP is specifically responsible for artisans, the National Artisan Moderating Body. QCTO is going to be responsible for all occupational trades, not just the artisans. So people who are doing business studies, for example, would not be catered for in NAMP, but QCTO has a responsibility. Now, we have to say what is the role and responsibility of NAMP versus QCTO with respect to artisans. They must have a relationship, and we have to clarify that relationship and make sure that all of these things are set up. It won't be nice and tidy, but at least there must be clarity. And as I've indicated, that we have to address integration and articulation. We cannot afford a situation where, for example, currently, people who have qualified from the FET section, your middle level skills, so an artisan cannot apply to a university. The university doesn't necessarily recognize the qualification from that other band. So we have to deal with the issues of articulation in that regard. Some of the developments, one of the challenges is in many respects, I think we have run ahead of ourselves on some things. Excuse me. We've kind of run ahead of ourselves in many respects. So we have the QC2O and the functions and responsibility thereof are already set up in the Act. And the Minister has signed a notice or gazette. So the difficult questions and terms, Adrian and Wilson will respond to, so they will clarify those things. So I'm speaking in my layman term. So the minister has signed, I think it's a notice or gazette that gives the QCTO the power. Now, it happened in a situation where we were not ready as the QCTO to be up and running and operational. So some of the functions are still in the CTAS. They are continuing in the CTAS. Now, to deal with the legalities of it, it means then QC2O and the CTAS, QC2O and Umalusi, we have to have an arrangement. So with regard to the CTAS, for example, what we have done is we are discussing the delegation of some of these functions back to the CTAS, because the establishment of the QCTO is taking these functions away from the CTAS. But because as the QCTO, we're not up and running, then we have to then delegate them back to the CTAS so that it's to deal with the legalities. We will be establishing, we are supporting the QCTO to get up and running. We will be, I think, finalizing the business plan to be submitted to Treasury, because QCTO was in fact listed as a public entity on the 31st of December, retrospectively from 1st of April 2010. So there are a number of things, though the Minister of Finance has written to the Minister of Education and Training to say, I'm listing QCTO, however, there are a number of things that you have to take into account and make sure that they are in place before you can be up and running. So we are dealing with all of those things, and including ensuring that the CTO has got a CEO. Currently we have the acting CEO, Adrian is here. So she has been holding the fort for quite some time. So as I indicated, some of those issues then means once they are addressed, then it's only then that QCTO can be up and running as a public entity. So currently it is still within the department, and we're establishing it and growing it and dealing with all of these policy matters that I've alluded to and addressing the clarification of roles and responsibilities and so on. So for now, QCTO is still using the systems in the Department of Higher Education and Training, and we are continuing to provide support and assistance. And financial allocations will also continue through the DHET until all of this is set up. Thank you, Chairperson and the members.
Let's just for the help of the members,
the QCTO is in terms of law established already, but for practical challenges, operationally it is still within the womb of the department.
Yes, that's correct.
And now, and it is at the same level as the NAMB, yes, in terms of artisan issues. And okay, and, that clarifies me. You nearly said before they could be established as a public entity. Yeah, so it was suggested to me that they don't exist in terms of law. They are still a conception, and I'll be worried how then you go about it. Oh, that's fine.
They exist, it's just a question of capacity at the moment.
Now, in the same vein, there is an issue where you're saying that some of the functions must still be executed by the sitters, and you are working on delegations. Does the Skills Act provide for such delegation? No, if it does, it's no problem. Okay, good. You can continue. Members, do you want to raise questions around this aspect? Oh, okay, that's fine.
Chair, I think you fully covered me on the first one. But I would just like to know, as we are saying, QCTO has already been established, meaning that, no, I'm not saying meaning that, I'm asking just to say, it has its role that has been put in place already. But as we are saying, we are taking some of those delegations like back to the sitters. Excuse me. Maybe if I can be clarified as to what are some of those duties or delegations that will be taken back to the sitters. And also, if you can just clarify the time frames as to say, when do you envisage QCTO being fully operational, being fully functional? Because when you read even on the operations side where you say it will use the Department of Education system at the initial phases from the 1st of April, I think I'm a little bit confused even there if it is said they will use it as from the 1st of April 2011. Where are you operating right now? What is happening, as I'm speaking, around QCTO, which has already been established, you see? So really, the delegation timeframes, when do you see you being fully operational, being fully functional, and what is happening right now up until the 1st of April, where you'll be getting in back to the Department of Education, using their system fully up until you are in good standing? Thank you.
Let me just understand one thing. Does it mean that now that we have got this one, the quality assurance on occupational and trades, the EP QAs will be de-established?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I have a comment and then a question. On the comment on the policy matters, I think it's encouraging to hear that you know, there is a priority to sort out you know, the what should be done and the roles and responsibilities between the qualifications bodies, being Umalusi, CHE, and the new one. It needs to be encouraged, and I think that one needs to be done properly so that we have a good working relationship, continuing to help South Africa developing skills. Then, Chair, the question that I have on the developments in the presentation, there is a one point which is saying that business plan to be submitted to National Treasury shortly. Now, that one is a sort of I have a concern with regard to that. And I will quote you, Chair, with your permission. How will you get out of the womb if you have not submitted your business plans? You will need funding. So today is budget. It's budget day. I'm just worried whether you will be provided for in today's budget. And if not, then we are in difficulty. Then we will continue to be in the womb maybe. Thank you, Chair.
Let's get responses.
Thank you, Chair and the members. I'll answer the simple questions and then Adrian will answer the difficult questions as the acting CEO. So she'll deal with the functions delegated to the CETAs. The process in terms of time frames, and it in fact relates to the point that is made on the developments with regard to business plan being submitted to National Treasury. If I can be frank on this one as well, Chair and members, we're a little bit ahead. So we were listed as a public, CTO was listed as a public entity before we could complete all the other processes. So normally the National Treasury would not list you as a public entity until you have submitted a business plan and it's approved. But this time they did it, which... And I think that is why after they've listed, then the Minister of Finance wrote to Minister of Higher Education and Training to say, while QCTO is listed, you have to make sure that the business plan is in place. You have the systems, HR and finance, and the bank accounts, and all the other systems. So the letter was basically saying that when the Minister of Higher Education and Training has satisfied himself that the QCTO has all the proper systems and can be up and running, he can then release the QCTO, so to speak, for a lack of a better phrase. So that is what we are working on. Now, what has happened is we have budgeted for QCTO in the department. So in the skills branch, there is a line item for QCTO, so it is funded. We, like most other entities and departments, we had asked for more from National Treasury, but we only got, I think, half of what we had asked for. So that is going to be utilized to get the QCTO up and running. Now, our intention is to make sure that QCTO is up and running as soon as possible, because it cannot continue to be in the Department of Higher Education and Training and operating in that area. So we are working on it, Chair, and I think internally we are working on processes and timeframes so we can keep updating the portfolio committee on where we are at with regard to the establishment of the QCTO. But there are a number of things, Chair, as I've alluded to, that we have to clarify first, and some of them are not that easy, even and particularly the policy matters, because there are institutions which have been established, Umalusi, for example, and CHE, who have their space and have always thought that they're doing certain things. So we have to clarify all of those things. It's a process. Practically, it does mean that ETQAs will be de-established. But it's also a process. So that is why we're doing the delegations, because QCTO is not up and running. It doesn't have the capacity to do the quality assurance, but the capacity is still there in the CETAs. So hence we are working on the delegations. But the minister has made it very clear that function has to move away from the CETAs, because it's one of the areas that is causing problems within the CETAs contributing to some of the inefficiencies in the CETAs. So the functions have to move from the CETAs to the QCTO, but because we're still capacitating QCTO, they continue for now up to a period. I think, Adrian, in the discussion with the CETAs, we are talking about the time frames in terms of the delegation for how long that would be. And then Adrian will respond to the difficult questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll do my best. I think as the DDG Skills Development has clarified, the introduction of the QCTO in 2008 was quite a big change. And it is important, therefore, to distinguish the past from the future. And in my answer to the question about what functions are being delegated, I need to answer in respect of the past and in respect of the future. Historically, when SACWA was responsible for designing qualifications, there were a number of qualifications that were registered on the NQF. Now, those qualifications were in the main, where they came from the labour market, were in the main quality assured by the CETAs. So the first delegation that we wish to give to the CETAs is the responsibility to continue to quality assure those historic qualifications, the ones that have been on the system in some cases, you know, for 10 or more years. And there are many of these qualifications, over 1,000 of them. And so we don't want to have a disruption. Many of those qualifications are useful, and hence it's to delegate to the CETAs the responsibility to continue to quality assure them. And that means things like accrediting the providers who deliver those programs and overseeing the assessments that take place at the end of them. So that's the first part of the delegation. It's in respect of the past, to make sure there's no big rupture. In respect of the way forward, there is also a proposal to start some pilot projects doing the work differently. The DDG Skills Development has said that there were many problems in the past about uneven quality, the CETAs did different things, and to rectify that, the QCTO is bringing in a system of national standards. They are no longer sectoral standards, they're going to be national standards. Let me give you one example. Historically, we had something like 8 different standards for electricians, because local government had an electrician and the manufacturing sector had electricians and the energy sector had electricians. Each one of those set different standards for an electrician. Now, obviously, the people who suffer there are the electricians themselves, who then can't easily move from one sector to another because it's not one qualification that gets recognized. So the new system will try and bring in national qualifications that you can move across sectors, and the method of doing that is very different. The QCTO will compel people to work together across sectors. It says if you want a qualification, you're going to have to work together across sectors. So it'll bring together people from the different CETAs. So what we're wanting to do, though, is to delegate a pilot project where we ask an individual CETA to act as the convener across other CETAs in respect of a particular occupation. Let's go back to the electrician. So one CETA, in this case I think it's the Mining Qualification Authority, is asking to have the job of convening everybody together to set the new standard for electrician, which will no longer be sectoral, it'll be national. But their job is not to do the work. They must convene experts, expert electricians from the different sectors. So they must play a convening role and they must play a funding role. They must fund it because the levy money covers this function. So that's what we're asking them to do into the future. We're identifying a number of occupations, particularly the trades, because these are a national priority, and to say we wish to get this new process going, which will remedy the problems of the past. And we're hoping to embark on that process of pilot projects very soon to support the national initiatives on trade and artisan training. I hope that helps. If there's more clarity, I'm happy to give it.
Yeah, no, thanks, Chair. I think the questions in the main are actually talking to the management and leadership of this transitional period so that we're able to migrate and align the system in a manner which is going to give the training optimal benefit for the country. So what we've done in the department in terms of management as well as leadership of the process, we brought all the quality council and we are managing and providing leadership in the process in a structured fashion. There's a forum where we're teasing out one, the processes and issues of alignment for the system. Secondly, taking into account the capacity constraints of QCTO as well as other quality councils, what then are the strategic partnerships that we need to consider? We've teased that out. And then work out a planned systemic phase-in so that the take-off is quite smooth and operations, you know, thereof, so that there is no disruption in the system. So there is a mechanism in place in terms of the management of the transition period. So what Percy and Adrian have given out is the details in actual fact that are underpinning that process. So it's a matter that we're not leaving to chance.
It sounds, was it me? Sounds very good. I think what we're interested to see is time frames. It's good and well to say that there are time frames, but I think from our side what we want is we want to see, you know, your key indicators, what you have set out by when, so that we can see exactly when this is all going to come together, when we're going to see the thing in action. Thanks, Chair.
Well, Chair, I think Honorable Nelson has just mentioned that because I need to see, you know, QCTO being independent, not relying to what's the Department of Education and Training. Know, and being specific to say, don't say by April we'll, you know, still continue working in the higher education and training, but when are you going to be able to be independent so that you operate solemnly with all the capacity that you need? Because we don't want you when we call you probably within the mid-year for you know, taking the updates, you tell us that you still don't have capacity. All these other challenges. That's why we're asking you, you know, specific time frame to say, at this time, we're expecting ourselves to be where. I just need to get again that clarity in terms of that pilot project that you said they're running. If you can just repeat that, what is it? The issue of the pilot project. Yes, sir.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, let me express my I don't want to call it happiness, but Chair, I am glad at long last that as a country we are moving towards coordination, because what we have before, you had these separate entities and training. I will train as I know at a technical college, they had a course on to do her hair salon, a 3-year course. And after some time, there was no longer that course, because if I am not good at academic level, then I want to go to be a technician. But because of, I don't know whether it was because of the apartheid, because of what, but I'm glad at the policy level, I am glad that there is this thinking, and actually this thinking is being presented to the committee. I think it will be our responsibility as a committee now to actually assist in terms of enriching that policy, so that we, at the end, that policy is being realized. But Chair, I also want just to find out from, you know, from the colleagues, in terms of, because I've seen at the your chat, you had different levels. You had Mama Lucy, you had the council, and then you had, I don't know what is the other side, where you have your managers and what, you know, the skills development. The question that I want to ask, Chair, I think it's also whether it's about coordination or partnership, because I know currently government, you have the institute that is called Paloma. Yeah, that trains government leadership. And then you also have GIPS that trains your executive. And then you have, there's a new kit on the block, which was launched in Sandton. What is it? The Thabo Mbeki Institute. So what I want to know, Chair, are you going also to have a partnership on those institutions in terms of sharing experiences, in terms of sharing the views and theories? Because I think you are sitting at different levels. Seeing that now, currently in the country, there is a particular ideology that we are pushing in terms of education, no matter how, which angle, but there is this particular ideology that we are pushing in terms of educating our society, whether informal or informal. I don't know whether you will have that. Thanks.
Before the response, I think there is that appreciation that we need this integrated and holistic system to come into place, and I think that's what you are managing. And the committee mainly suggests that there must be some expedition in that process, so that we should not be having some trade and occupations being in the cities that are stagnant in paralysis and so on. That is basically the concern, that there must be that migration of the skills, the experience, into this new body that is going to be a national system, no longer a central and, you know, segmented system and so on. Maybe just to amplify anything that you may want, so we can proceed. I'm sure we're in one voice on that.
No, thanks. On the time frames, it's really a matter that we are actually pushing quite very hard, you know, on it. But the determining factor is the question of the budget on it. Therefore, we have outlined our time frame informed by 2011 MTEF. That's what we're working on at the present moment. And we hope that process will take care of for us, because it would mean getting something substantially from the Treasury as well, taking into account the competing demands of the country. The second question Our keen interest is to ensure that the CTO is up and running on its own and it's independent. But it's a hard question that we had to pose to ourselves. Would we be just rushing for declaration of independence of this entity? Or the objective in the main is to ensure the functionality of the system. Then we opted for the second, that the functionality of the system in a more coordinated and less disruptive way is the key, because we can't afford any slowdown or disruption in the system at the present moment. So what then we are working to reinforce, which is informing, as to what are the strategic partnerships for QCTO, what then are critical alignment areas, and how do we also ensure that we extract maximum value from within all quality assurance bodies and entities that are operating under the auspices of the Department of Higher Education and Training, so that we ensure that there are less disruptions, because the pressure in the system is quite huge. So that's what is really informing, you know, our functionality and effectiveness of the system. We are actually mindful that we have to move speed at the same time within the 2011 MTEF towards full operation and establishment of the QCTO. Yeah, maybe this will take the last question.
Thank you. Maybe before I take the last question, I think it's important that, because I understand that the issue of the time frames is important, not only for the members here, but for all of us and for the greater public out there. We can't be talking ad infinitum about getting established without the control measures, one of which is time frames. In terms of the current operational plan for 2011, there are many issues that are prioritized by QCTO, but if you sum them up together, the issue of establishment needs to be finalized in 2011. And inside establishment, we've got lots of issues. They are the issues to do with the actual establishment of the organization in terms of its organograms and capacity, in terms of the hiring of the necessary people, the CEO's appointments, and all sorts of other people. The issue of the structure within, the issue of the location of the QCTO, the issue of systems in the QCTO, as well as the issue that has been well indicated here of the clear establishment of the strategic partnerships that work strategically with the QCTO. We do not want to come here in 2011, in 2012, and talk again about the issues of getting QCTO established. We want to start reporting on progress of how QCTO is doing in terms of its work in 2012 going forward. Then there was a specific question on these other structures like Palama, Gibbs, Tabumbeki Institute, and many others. There are many others, like a range of over 200 professional bodies that play different roles, and we have also prioritized these as part of our attainments in 2011, so that the configuration of how QCTO works with these structures, including professional bodies, is clearly clarified and established, and all those things. It's not only about delineations of roles, but it's also about capitalizing on the value that could be added in terms of working profitably and positively with those strategic partners that are in there. They are certainly in our priorities for 2011 as well. They include the other QCs in particular, like the CHE, and as well as Umalusi, because there are many issues which, for as long as we have not resolved in 2011, they make it very difficult to finalize the issues of the definition of the sub-framework for QCTO, because some of them hinge on the kinds of the relationship and the understandings that are established between QCTO and those other structures. But it's certainly priority, and a lot of our operations are targeting 2011.
2011 to ensure that then in 2012 we are talking about how well we are doing in terms of the operations of the QCTO. Thank you.
Just one question relating to funding. Would the National Treasury be able to channel resources prior to the advancement of this business plan? What are the arrangements around that in terms of that process, so that we know what are the bottlenecks that we need to be dealing with?
No, we're engaging with the Treasury on the financial matters. And at the end of the day, it really entirely depends, you know, in that process. It's very difficult to predict and forecast what would be the outcome is. But the critical question is, within the resources that are available, what are we able to extract maximum value and impact?
Acting DG, I just want to know from the colleagues that did they do a case study on this, the model that we are coming? Do you have you compared to other countries, or have you found out from other countries that they are similar to this situation?
We've undertaken elaborate investigations and studies worldwide on this particular matter.
Chairperson, we've had some frustrations prior to the establishment of this occupations and trade quality assurance in terms of fast-tracking issues of RPL. I just want to know that now with this advent of this body, how will that be enhanced? Did it ever cross your mind to say how will you unlock some of the challenges in that regard?
Andre, there is a question. I want to know, cognition of prior learning, would it be really addressed, given that now you are transformational in character, you'd understand that those that are doing this work and so on?
Thank you. I'm happy to report that today, tomorrow, and Friday, the SACWA is convening a national conference on RPL. And much, the attendance has been huge. They've had to turn people away because the venue was too small. You know, they hadn't anticipated the level of interest. So there is huge amount of energy that is taking place on RPL. All of the three QCs have been invited to that meeting. And indeed, we will be making our contribution through one of our other colleagues at that meeting. But all of the QCs must make a contribution to RPL. I think the QCTO has a particular role to play because it is many workers who have attained experience at work who will be seeking recognition for those skills. And certainly the model that QCTO has developed will lend itself to workers being able to get their skills recognized, and we are building it in to every stage. In other words, we're putting it in as mainstream and not seeing it as something that comes later. So it's being designed into the model. But as I say, we will be playing our active part in regard to RPL, but I think other QCs are also doing the same, and SACWA is leading a big national debate on it as we speak.
Yeah, and just to share more on that, this in actual fact is coming, you know, about as a result of the insistence and the initiative by the minister on the RPL, because his views is that it's a matter that we dragged for quite long. We need to shape it up. I'm supposed to be there this evening. I'm not sure whether I'll make it, because we're to prioritize. I had to be here. So we're looking at rushing back. We're not even staying for the budget speech as a result of that. So it's a matter really which is receiving our utmost attention.
Chair, may I must correct the acting DG. It was the initiative of this portfolio committee, not of the minister. And we given the minister an instruction that he must pay serious attention after our oversight visit in Limpopo. And we written, I think, couple of reports to the minister in terms of this thing. And I'm, you know, we're quite surprised that, you know, we're not informed in terms of these things, because as a committee, we're expecting a feedback in terms of all the processes and progress, excuse me, in terms of, you know, initiatives that we come with and present it to the department.
I'm sure we are all not incorrect. We are speaking the same message. The department takes from the ministry, the minister takes from the portfolio committee, and that's a continuum of a very complex system that operates that way. Let's get what our presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, even before we go into the presentation itself, I need to share this with the committee that the center in Lela was actually managed as a standalone, separate, almost having a certain measure of autonomy from the then Department of Labor. And as a result, then it developed a lot of parallel systems to that of the department. And I think, in a way, some of the excesses that came to emerge was as a result of that level of autonomy. I think that's the first point that I needed to make. But the second point, in respect of the presentation itself, Chairperson, I also needed to begin to deal with the transitional period. From the time when the presidential proclamation was issued, transferring administrative and operational functions from the Department of Labor to the newly created Department of Higher Education and Training. Now, that may as well have happened around the 4th of September 2009. However, because it was in the middle of the financial year, and therefore there were challenges around budget transfers and all those aspects, actual transfer then because of the budget of the 21st of April 2010. And the actual staff movement began from that period. But during the transitional period from the issuing of the proclamation and April 1st, 2010, there were interactions to some extent that staff were at some point sent to the new department to assist with the one or the other operation, just to assist with the setup of the department. And in that very same period of the handover, briefings were done that the Department of Labor has received from some complaints from some of the parties at Indlela about the excesses that occurred at Indlela. But around, let's say, from that period when the minister was informed, let's say around May of 2010, which is the next slide, when those concerns were then raised with the minister and the DG, the minister then instructed the department to institute a forensic investigation, because there were a string of very worrying allegations, a range of them. And in this instance, then, that process then was initiated around May of 2010. A company called OMA was then appointed to conduct this forensic investigation at Indlela. Now, going to the next slide, Chair. The challenges that the company was then instituted to investigate related to matters around assessment at Indlela. Indlela, remember, members of the committee, it's a trades testing center. So that is its core business. And therefore, one of the key challenges around assessment were with regard, for instance, to registration, where if you come in to register to be tested in a specific trade within assessment section, there is a registration queue. but we'll then find that some people are able to jump the queue. And in that sense, monies were exchanged. But there were also challenges around fixed assets. There were challenges around the housing itself, overtime payment, the kitchen, the management of the kitchen, preparation of meals, for instance. In fact, most of the excesses even occurred around the kitchen, where you'll find that they'll procure a knife, a bread knife, for 500 rand. Those are the kind of things that then emerged. Those are the excesses that emerged. There was also challenge around overtime and leave, abuse of government transport. There was also a fund they called the Social Club Fund, which was managed by the staff member Setin Lela, and it generated lots of funds, and it even had its own account. And I think it's one of the funds that was used to promote patronage. You know, if you are with us, you stand to benefit, you know, all those kind of things. But also challenges around supply chain management, lots of challenges were also emerging around supply chain management. Now, alongside the appointment of the audit firm, OMA, to do a forensic investigation, the department also appointed a consultant parallel to that, to then say, look, we can't wait for all these challenges to be uncovered and brought out to the surface. It is critical that we bring in an intervention at the department as well, because if there's hemorrhage, one of the things you need to do is to stop the bleeding. You can't then say, look, let's investigate what is the cause of the bleeding and so what causes this and so on. So the department then put in place this person who came to assist in strengthening the system. Among others, I mean, you see the next two, three slides are the kind of things that this consultant, when he came in to provide that support, then started putting these systems into place to ensure that at least we effect preventative measures, you know, to stop these challenges from continuing. Among others, there was a lot of confusion because there was no control of our personnel. Any person will be able to move between the center itself, which is located at Olifantsfontein, just next to the airport, and go to 123 Schoeman Street, where the department is. Now, during the course of the day, you might have half the staff leaving the center to take the one or the other document to 123 Schoeman Street. I mean, that's very disruptive. So one of the measures then to admit that, to bring discipline and control, was to introduce a messenger service. Such a simple thing. But there was also the issue of private catering. If I want to organize catering, Angela has excellent facilities in terms of halls and what have you. I mean, I spoke of a kitchen now and so on. It even has a golf course. Now, you will find then that individual staff members, without any processes being followed, will then come forward and render a catering service. You'll just see in a while group of people coming from wherever to have a function at Indlela, and the caterer is a staff member. I mean, we don't do these things within government, among others. But also the manner in which you manage bank deposit, anything went. The one time this person is sent, the other time that person, and obviously losses can occur. Sometimes even deliberate losses. I'm not suggesting that is the case, but I'm saying if there is no proper measures and control in place, we are bound to have these challenges. But also the question of the control of petrol cars. I mean, there was no control whatsoever with regard to the use of the petrol cars. Angela also within its campus has some houses that it has that are utilized by some of the staff members. And therefore, without any policy, management can then use that as patronage, trying to get patronage favors from people. If you are with me, you will get a house. If you are a problem, sorry, you will not get a house. You know, those kind of things. So there was those level of abuse and even a misuse of government assets. But then we find some of the officials that stayed there had a massive shortfall. They did not pay. They were staying for free for quite some time. So one of the measures that was supposed was to then begin to ensure that everybody pays whatever he owes to the guard department. There was also the issue around the housing policy, as I've indicated, challenge around the housing policy. We developed a housing policy, which we then sent through to 1 to 2 months before approval, so that at least there is order in the manner in which you manage those houses at the end. But also the question of standardized gate pass, the point I made earlier, people just, at the time, then were just coming and going as they please. The issue of the working hours, some people will decide to start at 7, some will start at 7:30, some will start at 8, some will decide to knock off at 12, some days. You know those type of things around the waiting hours. So the department then, last year, to the DG, issued a directive clarifying what are the working hours of the department, and Indlela then had to comply, like everybody else. There was also the question of private work at Indlela. Remember, Indlela is a trade testing center dealing with about 99 trades, from mechanical, electrician, construction, and so on. It has workshop facilities where these tests are conducted. Now, from time to time, you'll find that a person from outside will bring a vehicle, the vehicle to be spray-painted, to be panel-beaded, and so on and so on. Then it becomes a private job, you know. So one of the measures then that was then introduced last year was to put a stop to that. And a directive then sent throughout the campus that no more private jobs. But also some of the staff members will borrow some of the equipment. There's an equipment, for instance, the tester you use for electricity. I want to do a job over a weekend somewhere. I'll borrow the tester, you know, and go and do my business wherever, and bring it back. So that as well was prohibited. There was the issue around the petty cash. There was the issue around the bidders as well, not properly being notified. Then the other challenge was with regards to the perimeter fence. I think prior to July 2010, if we were to check the trend in respect of theft around that time, they were massive, just because of the perimeter fence. I mean, Israel is about 18 acres. It's huge, the center itself. And therefore, people from time to time, you'll never know whether these are break-ins or the breakouts. In other words, it's people from inside actually breaking out to the fence and so on. So there are those challenges as well around the perimeter fence. But I think there was also a clear categorical directive from the minister and the DG that the abuse around the golf course there, the golf course must be closed because it was used by private individuals from the street who had their own club, paid fees, but those fees never found themselves to government coffers. It just went to the pockets of people, you know. And it was managed like a private golf course, and yet it was on the land of owned by government. So I think one of the clear directives then was to then say, close that golf course. But also, part of curbing theft and loss of assets within Indlela, there was no control at the security. People just came in, went out. There was no searching of vehicles and so on. So I could come in, my car empty, leave with my car full of equipment taken from the center itself. So I'm saying those things happen if there's no proper security measures at the gate. So among others, these are some of the actions that then we worked with that consultant, including control of key measures. I mean, everybody was having keys. Keys were lying all over the place, and so on and so on and so on. So moving on then to the next slide. So the challenge that I've alluded to earlier, the assessments one, the supply chain on slide 4. OMA was then appointed to conduct an investigation, which they did between May last year up to December. In December, they submitted a report. Now, the report was handed over to the department for it to process the report. But because of what emerged from the report itself, and as the DJ alluded to that earlier, the matter then has been shared with our law enforcement agencies, because clearly arising from that report, there may be a need for criminal proceedings to be instituted by against some of the individuals. But also our legal department is working on the report just to check that at least there are no possible legal ramifications and challenges around that. Where express individuals have been mentioned, the Departmental Labor Relations Unit and the legal unit are also charged with then putting together charges against those individuals. The signal that seems to be emerging from labor relations already is that it's not going to be anything less than 15 individuals that will be acted upon. But then we'll have to await that process as it unfolds for us to be able to say we take it forward. I want to thank you, Chair.
Why was this institution left to be like it is being presented now? Was it because of the ineffective of management or what? Because I don't understand. At this time of the year, we still have institutions that are not being managed properly. Thank you.
I'm just thinking, Chair, it's like this structure was created perhaps without a lot of clarity on what should happen. Whether they themselves were charged with establishment of policies, they did not establish them, and or they did but did not adhere to those, they did not observe them. But it's like they were created and left like that. It doesn't seem there was ever an audit on their financial statements, because they were not established, isn't it, for a year or two. So there could have been annual financial statements or auditing that should have taken place. Because when you look at the report, you hear that there was no policy on that, there was no policy on this, there was no policy. So it's not even easy to say they should have acted according to, they violated this kind of a policy or not. But just even their establishment, what did it mean? If you have to say you must charge people, are we charging them just based on some PMSA or draft internal policies that they should have been able to observe? If they did not exist, who are supposed to have ensured that this or same existed? So thanks.
Yeah, well, Chair, I think Honorable Mukwela is correct. You see, you charge people because, you know, they know the process, the procedures of the institution and how it's supposed to operate. unless that system is being established, because I'm trying to look at I want to get the feeling of the unions there. What were their feeling after the engagement with the minister and the department in terms of clarifying this thing that this has not been going very well? I'm trying to check, because, you know, must also be careful of issues that whereby the union will say, but these prevention measures were not there. And then you find yourself having loggerheads with the union. But I just want to check, man. I have a slight challenge with these consultants being appointed in, you know, assisting government. Whether doesn't the department have enough capacity, human resource to, you know, do those things? Because my understanding is that the department has, you know, those resources. It's a simple thing. Issues of supply chain management, issues of procurement, you know, these are the standardized issues in all government aspects, including private sectors for that matter. You know, those control measures, they are supposed to be there. I trying to get a sense that it was my thinking is that probably we might be wasting more money by appointing consultants whereas we don't have resources. But also, I'm trying to check, because already it has happened, how long is the consultant going to remain? When are you envisaging to install a full office management structure that will operate there, you know? That will not be on a base of consultants, because consultants are paid within hourly base and all that stuff. Lastly, Chair, is that we must appreciate that, you know, at least the department has, you know, taken, you know, put it the OMA and all other measures. But where do you want to see this institution going? As from now, how are you going to ensure that there's proper smooth operation? Because this is an institution that must produce these skills for South Africa. Because if you know, there's no proper measures, that means within also the qualification aspects, there's no monitoring tool that also ensuring that there's a proper quality results that are produced there. Thanks, Chair.
Chairperson, thanks. Yeah, I think the silence is like more shock than anything else to hear that we could still have things like this happening. No, but I'm glad anyway, Chairperson, that the department has picked this up and could deal with it quite decisively. While I was listening to this, I was saying to myself, where was the accounting officer, the person that was responsible for this institution? And the question that came up to me was, if this consultant was appointed and the consultant had to come up with these strategies that had to be put in place, what was the role of the accounting officer of the institution? And I'd be interested to know if the accounting officer, whatever the person is called, is still within the institution. Because it would be quite horrifying to think that someone that's the head of institution, that was supposed to be running this institution, couldn't put these mechanisms into place. So, but maybe there's more behind it that we don't know about. So I'm just interested to know about the accounting officer. Is that person still in the institution? And what kind of punitive action is going to be taken? Because I think that is the most important thing. You know, a message must go out very clearly that we cannot run our institutions in this fashion, and it will be dealt with very harshly. To pick up on what my colleague has said, Sibol, risk management. Has the department got a risk management plan in place, a department? Because obviously there are other organizations with Section 21 organizations, and you've got all the CETAs, you've got, what is the risk, is there a risk management plan within the department? Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I was actually covered by the previous speakers, but just to say that I think that the appointment of the consultant was unnecessary, in my understanding, because the forensic audit would have brought out those things in any case. Then secondly, to bring up a point of what Mr. Honorable Makubela said, now that we see that the forensic audit is now saying that disciplinary actions will be taken, the other side of the same coin is also important. What I'm trying to say is that we don't hear of any remedial steps other than disciplinary hearings. Because I think to put into place or recommendations about systems to make Indlela work, for instance, financial system, other managerial operational systems should be in place. I think that is part of a forensic audit, and not only to give us the guilty ones. Who is guilty or who are guilty? Thank you, Chair.
Chair, mine will be very short. My interest is Indlela still doing its core functioning? That is, the trade testing, etc. What is the level of that? Was it not affected by all this report that we're getting? Really, if you look at the core function of it, was it still delivered the way it was expected to do? Thank you.
Mine, Chair, would just be a comment. From the presentation, at face value, we would safely say the institution was run down actually for purposes of serving the interests of individuals. And then it would be proper if disciplinary measures are taken promptly, because I suspect that if it is prolonged, evidence would be destroyed and it would be difficult to prosecute some of the people involved. Thank you.
Usually when we come to the committee, we become very clinical in terms of our approach issues, the questions that we ask. I do not ask those ones. If you say you have spoken to or you have got collaboration with law enforcement agents, exactly what you mean. Are you saying you've approached the station that we call it now? The chair, the head of a police station.
Coronet.
Yes, or you've spoken to the SIU and they've got the forensic report, they're dissecting it, following individuals who are being interviewed for possibly criminal charges. The SIU deals with civil matters where we can recoup money that have gone into private pockets and so on, so that we are clear. Ultimately, we will, as this committee, require to see for ourselves the forensic audit. We understand what the acting DG said about sub-judice. I did not want to take him to task on that because that principle doesn't apply to Parliament. Once Parliament requires any document, that document must be presented, and nobody in the country can use it for either criminal or civil matters. So that also in the private environment, it is a notion that is beginning to weaken because of the nature of our democracy. South Africa has reached a particular level where people talk about criminal cases openly. If I'm charged of rape, the following morning newspapers talk about it. On the radio stations, people are calling in. Now, that principle no longer applies. It is only existing in the minds of people, particularly in government, because they always refer it in government. If you go to the private sector, they know that principle no longer applies. If you read judgments now, you will see judges are no longer willing to enforce it. Usually it comes into place when a judge in a court of law says, do not speak on this. But if there's no judgment, a ruling, in fact, because the ruling, then anybody can talk about that matter anyway. But let's not, if indeed these matters have been taken to the SIU, to police stations, we may not want to reflect on nitty-gritties. Perhaps this committee will be very interested to know, Ndlela, at the moment, do they have a risk management strategy? Do they have a fraud prevention plan? Is the CEO and the CFO, if this structure does have such people, are they still there or in jail as a consequence of this? Or they just resigned upon seeing the forensic auditors after being interviewed? They just even were ashamed to go back to work, realizing that they've run down this institution. So that this committee has a sense of the issues in that broad framework, if indeed the difficulties are going to be investigated and have been dealt with at the level, so that then we should not meddle that process. Once a document is presented here, it becomes a public document. Now those people, regardless of the fact that now you cannot take action against them and so on and so on, they now develop defensive mechanisms on the basis of our report and so on. Let's hear the sense.
Thanks, Chair. I will take some of the questions and to Clive. As a person operating there, we'll take some. I think in regard to the first question, won't be able to give an adequate answer to that question because this is the function we are inheriting from a Department of Labor. I think they would better answer that part. We won't be able as a department. So we come in when the proclamation was made by the President, which is transferring the function to the Department of Higher Education and Training when it was established in terms of that proclamation. Now, there are very focused questions that are asked, which would then pertain to how the operations were. For instance, Honorable Member Makube, we won't know whether the Internal Audit Committee was up and running in the Department of Labor at that stage. We won't know whether there was risk management policy strategy at that stage. We won't know as to whether there was a plan to mitigate, risks in that environment. Those things we don't know. But it appears that some of the things were not picked up even during the processes of Auditor General. They managed to slip up. I don't want to make an emphasis on that. Because the basis on which we acted as a Department of Higher Education and Training is only through whistleblowing. When this was given to us, people came and said, no, there are things that are untoward happening there. And on those basis, we started then to institute the processes of investigation, on the matter. We commissioned the forensic investigation. And then these are the outcomes that have actually come out. Now, in taking the matter up, when the report was given to us by the forensic investigators, one of the things was to work out what are the cases that warrant disciplinary action right now. Secondly, then looked that other cases would require criminal charges more than just disciplining. Then we approached SAPS, we sat down with them, and they've taken the matter, you know, over. So there are those investigations that are taking place on criminal basis. Now, upon having been alerted and having taken these actions, then the question was, how do we relate to this situation? The first thing was to get in and strengthen systems. So we asked then the services of a consultant to actually get in and assist us on that, because the department itself is still in the formation phase. It doesn't have that full capacity. We are working on a very skeleton staff. So those systems are there in place. Then we're streamlining the functions of the department. We're centralizing HR, procurement, the entire supply chain away from Indlela as it used to happen, and strengthened control measures there, whether in terms of security and the other measures that are required. The accounting officer, yes, there is somebody who has an accounting officer, and it's a guy, according to the report, which has really amassed a lot of money. I think it's around 53% of the total budget of Indlela was misappropriated. 53%, it's around there. Yeah. It's a very huge, meaning therefore, in terms of wastage, theft, fraud, what have you, was more than 50% compared to what should have gone to operations and the functioning of that institution. Now, how did it happen? Why? We're not able to answer that question. Somebody else, you know, care. The consultant that was requested is Barnard, eh?
Philip Barnard.
Yeah, Philip Barnard. Barnard. He was requested to get in so that we're able to take away operations and day-to-day management of that institution from those people who are implicated there. That's what we did in the first instance. And in that process, we worked towards appointment of a person who would be full-time in the institution. That's when Clive came in to take charge of the institution. That's what we have done, amongst other things. If I've left, because there are some other detailed questions that you need to actually get into. We are really pursuing arrests, criminal charges. We don't have those skills. Yeah, SAPS have. Those that we have of executing disciplinary actions, we are working on them. And will be quite decisive. Thank you.
Well, through you, Chair, just clarity. So the consultant, the contract of the consultant has been terminated.
Maybe, Chair, just to add, I think DG has covered a lot of ground. But let me preface my response with the following. It's very critical for us to understand. Indlela was managed as a directorate within the Department of Labor then. It was a directorate. It was not a public entity. It was not an organization on its own, but it was a directorate. However, because it was a center, it was also managed as a regional office. You know, it had this autonomy. You know, a directorate will have an integral link to the organization right up to the upper structures. But while being a directorate, it was then managed and given a certain level of autonomy. I think that's where the challenge emerged. That's the first thing, because it's not physically in the department, or it was not physically in the department then. And therefore, it does not have an accounting officer, CFO, and what have you, because that will be the departmental processes. But secondly, DHEC noting these challenges that we're addressing today in this meeting, it then sought to deal with them decisively. So the person brought in was actually a former CFO of the then Department of Education. I was in there at the time. There was no capacity. The department is still in its formative stages, trying to create capacity department, and now this allegation have emerged. Something drastic had to happen with immediate effect. And therefore, when I was brought in, he was appointed around April. When I was brought in July, for that period, he was then made to report to me. It was now I was there to manage the process. Then we're able then to round off whatever he had to do, and we terminated his contract. So he didn't stay on. He left last year. I just wanted to put that in perspective. But my coming in as well was an attempt by the department to bring that intervention to ensure that they begin to ensure that there is specific attention paid to Indlela as an integral part of the head. Not as a standalone, autonomous, or anything of that sort. It was therefore made into a chief directorate within Department of Higher Education and Training. So it's not a standalone center. It is now managed in terms of departmental processes as a chief directorate. So in that sense, then, it's an opportunity as well to eliminate some of these excesses. But over and above that, the department, yes, currently now as we speak, does have a risk management strategy that it has put into place that incorporates Indlela as part of that to ensure at least that those excesses don't get repeated, so to speak. And without necessarily wanting to address each and every point that were raised, because I think we've given the broad thrust of what members were asking, I will say then maybe let me leave it at that, and thank you, Chair.
Well, the main question now is whether Indlela is able to function effectively as it's supposed to do. With your coming in and everybody else, are we able to, do what the core mandate of Indlela is supposed to do? Having taken some people who are awaiting either disciplinary or criminal charges and so on, so is it able to, as an entity, to deliver?
I just wanted to check that the issue of operation, but also in terms of the whether the assets have been audited, because all those things, you know, will also impact and also the operation of Indlela. It's a trade center, you know. It's got many assets that, you know, got possibility of getting lost. That will also hamper in terms of. I'm trying to check also the whether the assets have been audited. Yes.
Chair, Indlela, yes, has been able to continue its operation. It is still continuing its operation as we speak. There are no major challenges in that regard. But definitely, going to the future, there will be a challenge. If what emerges from the report itself and a large number of people are then taken up into disciplinary proceedings, it will definitely have direct impact on operation. But that is something we need to manage internally as a department going forward.
No, I think it is clear that the department's assets.
I'm getting engrossed now into this. The asset has been audited. What is currently happening, there is a process that is happening between the Department of Higher Education and Training and the Department of Labor, where they want to check all the assets that need to be transferred to the joint. That process has not been concluded. There are still some areas of disagreement that have been dealt with internally between the two departments.
Yeah, to put it a little bit simpler, Corp operation is not what it should be. Yeah, I think it explains.
The way we colleagues, we have the picture. As they speak, in my mind, I can form quite a picture of Indlela. I can see just probably 80% of people being dismissed, you know. If we are to go that clinical path, so labor relations experts know how to handle that. I'm sure that is their role. They know exactly how they can manage that. At what level can they put liability in terms of all this and so on? Probably at the highest level. I think the lower part of the middle segment could have been contaminated by the rotting of the head and so on, and other crucial elements. I'm sure that they can deal with, may not deal with at this level. I think that just clearly gives us a picture of the challenges there, and we've been given an assurance that they are intervening, and indeed work has been done. Could I say that maybe summarizes our perspective on Indlela? What we need to say to the department acting DG is that it is our observation that there is morass in terms of supply chain management, particularly in most, if not all, our sitters. They don't follow the Public Finance Management Act. They're operating like it is a home business. Now, we as a committee are going to up responsibilities at that level. I think we will cooperate with the AG. The AG does not undertake a forensic audit without a request. What they do sampling, and on that basis, things may fall through. If in that sample things are clean, then you'll get a clean audit. But if we do request, can you look into this area? Then they will put all their systems directly in that area and check. And I think we must make it very clear that we want to go into the area of accountability, so that we can safeguard the assets and resources of the state. And that will go for higher education institutions, for the FETs, for the CETAs. And in fact, the AG had consulted with us to say that they are coming to your office to indicate that they're going to undertake an audit from now onwards of all higher education institutions and the FETs. So it's about years now. That is the area in which we're going. So that we should not give funds to institutions that don't account in respect of those funds and so on, so that we can start curtailing some of these excesses that are beginning to show. In fact, you might find that Ndlela is an understatement if we are to speak of the anarchy that takes place in these various institutions. Now we will cooperate with the department in that respect. We'll give it the necessary support because it is our responsibility to ensure that there is accountability. That is the message that we want to send. We want to thank you for your well-articulated presentations. We'll continue calling upon you to come. We've got many institutions. This is a big department. So you'll always see yourself here, because we really have got to deal with all these institutions. I must also thank members for their inputs and contributions and all other participants in the meeting. This serves to conclude our meeting. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.